thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast.
William Gibson in conversation with Cory Doctorow on October 4th, 2010.
Are you going to go up to the podium?
Yeah. Well. Hello. I've been asked to introduce Zero History and briefly describe its themes, and that request throws me back to the beginning of the pre-launch, pre-tour phase of the publication of Zero. Because I can't put my hands in my pockets. It's the wires. But every time I publish a book, the first thing I'm asked is, what's it about? And what the themes are. And it puts me in an awkward position because I don't work that way at all. I don't have ideas and generate narratives in order to illustrate them. And in fact, when I'm actually not writing fiction, I scarcely have ideas at all. And I find that to be a fairly happy state for the most part. But when I write fiction for, you know, whatever reasons, I find ideas through the narratives. They're not always very defined, but as I continue with the narrative, they tend to recomplicate and circle around and come back. And you know, at the beginning of my career, I secretly suspected that I was only pretending to be a novelist and that I'd found a way to cheat and do something that looked like a novel and was shaped like one and provided an experience rather like reading one, but that I was actually cheating because I was forcing the reader to provide the ideas. That I would get the ideas and the themes were only revealed to me after the book published and read and responded to. And I've gradually, since I've been doing this for a while, I've gradually come to the conclusion that in a way that's exactly the case, but that's okay. So that I'm getting my ideas from you, and I'm finding out what the book's themes are from the readers. And I think that the next work for me always emerges from that. Someone always tells me in the course of all these post-publication exercises what the current book is about. And it hasn't quite happened with this one, although I think it may be getting there. And it's something like, people keep asking, some journalists ask whether or not I look at this particular three-book movement as three snapshots of the zeitgeist taken over the previous 10 years or so. And I was saying, no, not exactly. But I've started to realize that the thing I'm disagreeing with is snapshots. What I think these three books are is a sort of very, like a decade-long pinhole exposure on the first decade of the 21st century. And in some very real sense, the camera doesn't move very much. The film stays where it is, and the decade passes, and my characters, in some ways, repeat actions from the previous books, and so the whole thing becomes, the three books become a sort of palimpsest, where one book, the one narrative is superimposed on another, and at the end of the sequence, you're looking through it all back to the beginning. At least it's like that. It's like that for me. And I think that's about all I have to say about it. So you can see why I never like to address these questions. But thank you very much.
I get the feeling it's like there was a paper set for you, and there were a bunch of essay questions, but at the beginning there was just a little blank for you to write, what state concisely the theme of this book, and you just ended up turning over the paper and filling up the entire paper with that first question, never got on to the next one. I have a hypothesis, actually, about what the theme of the book is, and I think that it's related to the themes of your other books, which is, it's a kind of exploration of why Bohemia matters, what threatens Bohemia, why it's so incredibly fun to threaten Bohemia and to exploit and commodify subculture, and just why people actually run around doing it and how seductive that might be. And I got this idea when I went back and looked over the interview we did for the Globe and Mail in 1999, I think, for Tomorrow's Parties. And that's what we were talking about back then, too. We were talking about this idea that marketing companies and corporations had figured out how to commodify Bohemia so quickly that it may not even exist anymore, that we went from a year for punk to show up in the high street, 6 months for grunge, and now, then, it seemed like it was happening really quick. What I wonder, though, now that you're participating in this kind of network subculture, is do you see that still happening? Do you think that there's a big end who's going to figure out how to commodify 4chan? You know, is Anonymous ever going to become a high street brand?
I don't think so. I have, my sense of it is that we've rolled over into something else, and Bohemians don't live where they used to. It's like it's distributed now. It might not even be. You know, people who seem to be full-on Bohemians, whatever that would mean today, often seem archaic to me. It seems it's almost an archaic stance, but I meet people who have really strong splinters of Bohemianism through otherwise conventional personalities and lifestyles, and that feels new to me.
Do you think that this is this is a feature and not a bug, that we've kind of figured out how to make our peace with the commodification of the things that are personal and how to kind of peacefully coexist with this commodification by allowing these splinters to define our identity instead of saying I am goth, fear me?
Yeah, it might be, but it might also be that commodification may have made itself less possible through the virulence of its previous mechanism. Like we no longer grow. We no longer grow the full beef of Bohemia. It's all veal now.
And Does Bohemia still matter? I get the impression when I go back and read the earlier books that there's kind of lurking in them a belief that Bohemia it's like our soul. It's the secret wellspring of our power as people, and that when it goes away, that we lose something that we never get back again. But you know, in the last three books, you've really made taking away people's Bohemia for fun and profit seem really exciting and somewhat cool. Does Bohemia still matter? Did it matter then? Am I wrong about the relationship you had to Bohemia in the earlier books?
No, I don't think you're wrong, and I don't feel as though I'm reneging on it, but I think its nature has changed. I think Bruce Sterling was the first person to suggest to me that Bohemias have been the dream time of industrial societies, and that was really, really resonant for me. But if we are in fact a post-industrial society now, are Bohemias the same thing? Bohemias may have been a function of the modern project, and now we're somewhere else, and all of that impulse may have been paid forward into something that we can't yet really, really see because it's so new.
So back in 99, we talked about Japanese subculture, which in 99 was still pretty firmly Bohemian. You needed to really work at it to be a North American anime fan.
Yeah.
Whereas today, you kind of have to work actively to avoid it.
Yeah.
And at the time, I said, Japan, well, Japan's kind of cool, but why not China? And you said, Chinese popular culture has never evoked that instant of, whoa, what's that? And that was 99, obviously. That was just before the WTO, just before the largest migration in human history, just before China assumed factory duty for the rest of the world. It's probably true that, like, 95% of the manufactured objects in this room came from somewhere near Guangzhou. Do you still have how do you feel about China these days? You know, that container ships are showing up in your books. Is China on your mind?
You know, it's still not doing it for me. And I don't know what that is, except that I'm not really in the business of registering, whoa, you should check this place. You know, I think because I got in a bit early with the Japanese thing, like I made Japan a superpower in my fiction about 2 seconds before the world noticed that Japan had actually become an economic superpower. So they said, he's prescient. Look, he saw it. But actually, I just liked Japan, and I continue to find Japan a really interesting place. I try to find China a really interesting place. And, you know, I'm a monthly faithful giant robot reader. And, you know, I keep hoping that they will lead me into some wonderful hookup with Chinese pop culture. But it never quite makes me jump. I like it. I like Chinese popular culture better when it's left home and being affected by another place.
What's an example of that?
Well, giant robot off the top.
But not, is Singapore still Disneyland with the death penalty?
I'm not willing to go back and find out.
You know, it's funny. When I went there a few years ago with Bruce Sterling, everyone I met said, you know, we're not Disneyland with the death penalty. Literally every single person I met, they've got this complex about it now.
Well, you know, good for me. Maybe they'll do something about it.
So you say you had the inadvertent prophetic moment with Japan, and you were just introduced as someone who's prophetic. And I my reading of the way you think of your work is that it's anything but prophecy. Is that right?
Yes.
And so what is it? It's presentism. What's presentism when it's at home?
Well, when you... if I were teaching a science fiction writing course, I think I would tell my pupils that the way to have people think you've got some sort of, you know, inside deal on what's going to happen is to look at all the things that are around you in the present moment and find the ones that have the most interesting or obvious legs to carry them into the future. And because really I think that's how we all do it. We may not all think of it in the same way, but I'm currently assuming that all science fiction is based on the author's sense of reality now. And that's certainly how we read it in retrospectively when we go back and study science fiction historically, that it's not about the future, it's about 1948.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that this is the case. I think you find out a lot about any culture's fears and aspirations for technology by reading what its science fiction writers were predicting about the future. You find out almost nothing about the future that they entered, but you find out a lot about their present. I brought this up on a panel once at a convention, and Silverberg said, oh yes, that's the Robert A. timeline business. So Robert A. Heinlein was always putting these long timelines in his books of what he apparently earnestly thought was the future. Do you think that there's like a moment at which science fiction writers understood that was just hubris, or do you think that we've actually reached that, or is it a small elite club of SF writers who feel this way?
I don't know. I grew up with those timelines. I've realized recently, thinking about my childhood, that I educated myself in the history of the previous 20th century by reverse engineering 1940s science fiction. Mm-hmm. So I found 1940s SF before I had ever read any history at all, and even before the 20th century was on television. And the 20th century was quite a lot of my basic history education. But I had to reverse engineer all those astounding stories that I would find moldering in the backs of magazine shops. I had to figure out what the world was in which they had been written in order for them to make any sense.
So, for me, the fascinating thing is what happens when readers read science fiction and go on not to write more science fiction, but to make stuff. And to make stuff that has the science fictional bit in it. When Motorola engineers go out and watch a lot of Star Trek and come up with a flip phone. And, you imagine somewhere Roddenberry is going, I predicted it. But it's not really a prediction at all. And you've had certainly a lot of those crop up. What's your relationship like with them? Is there a kind of fatherly pride, embarrassment, something in between?
Well, I didn't think, I mean, when I started writing science fiction, I didn't think of myself as a person writing cautionary tales. And I didn't think of myself as a, a person predicting the future, but you know, in the course of writing, I realized that I was describing some fairly troubled relationships with technology, and trying to describe the emotional, to some extent, the emotional lives of people living in those relationships with technology. And that seemed to me to be at the core of what I was doing. And I remember being slightly taken aback when I first met people whose reading of my fiction was completely technical, and who felt nothing but enthusiasm and a burning desire to build it and have it right now.
I would like to have the emotional life of a Panther Modern. How do I go about achieving that?
How can I do that? So, but you know.
Well, I think it's because they were all so bohemian, right? I mean, you know, for all of their failings and for all that, you know, Molly Muirshades had to go be a sex slave in order to get her claws implanted, she was insanely cool, right? I mean, she was part of the bohemian world, and she was not some self-loathing Trustafarian in, you know, Brooklyn or Shoreditch. She was like the real authentic thing. And so, of course, people who read that stuff went, gosh, wouldn't it be awesome to be like that?
I suppose. I mean, I never thought that they were that remarkably bohemian, those characters. I think it depends on one's experience level. And to some extent, Molly's cartoon-like. There are a couple of point-of-view flaws in Neuromancer where the book suddenly acquires a narrative voice, which it's not actually supposed to have in quite that way. And one of those is one in which it suddenly goes off on this rant about how Molly is like Bruce Lee and Clint Eastwood. And, you know, she really is. She's like, at least in Neuromancer, she's like a really, really high quality cardboard life-size cutout. Hmm. Really like glossy and high res. But she's not, you know, she's not that much of a human. When she comes back later in the series, I was already, and she's older and has had some setbacks, I was already trying to find the emotional bandwidth I needed to represent human beings more naturalistically.
So getting back to Zero History, I think Big End is one of those people who, for all that he's a bit of a cipher, he's certainly in the round in that you really feel his kind of chortling glee at pulling apart these authentic subcultures and turning them back into brands. And it seems like it's the mirror image of the street finds its own use for things. This is Madison Avenue finding its own use for the street.
Yeah, Big End finds his own uses for things.
For the street.
For the street.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, is there a way that Big End could ever find a use for? We talked earlier about these diffused subcultures, and you said, well, they're too diffused to pick up. But some of them are just too toxic to pick up, right? Like, how would Big End commodify something like Anonymous, who, you know, for all the, they go around taking down horrible law firms that, you know, bulk sue British music downloaders. They're kind of horrible in a lot of really awful ways. How does that ever get commodified, or does it? Have they figured out the answer, and the answer is to just be so horrible that no one will ever, you know, just use the word fag as so often that no one will ever turn you into a brand?
Maybe. But it's, you know, how would you... I'm curious about how you would define a bohemia, or even not define, but how would you describe a bohemia in the sense we're both using it? Because for me, it has a lot, you know, there are a lot of things one needs to have a bohemia. Bohemians have dress codes and styles of romance and sexual mores, favorite drinks, specific kinds of music. That traditionally they've all had those. They've all had those things, and I don't think we have that today, because something has changed, and something's split off. And I was walking through Covent Garden today, and I saw a young man in a tweed jacket with a particular kind of beard, and I thought, D.H. Lawrence, hipster icon. This is these guys are trying to look like D.H. Lawrence, and that the way D.H. Lawrence looked is now much more powerful than what D.H. Lawrence wrote.
Huh.
And that's in some ways, it's not an entirely new ball game. I think it was happening in the 60s, certainly, and maybe earlier, but it's sort of become so much of the ball game now. And yet there wouldn't be an entire lifestyle attached to looking like D.H. Lawrence the way there once would have been. It would simply be, the thing would be to, you know, be a young man looking like D.H. Lawrence. And you could sort of pick and choose the rest of it.
So one of my favorite all-time William Gibson lines is, "Don't let the little fucker's generation gap you." And which is a neuromance, I think it's Dixie Flat line. And you know, whenever I run up against a subculture that seems, you know, just so offensive that it couldn't possibly be commodified, I always wonder, am I just being generation gapped? Am I just being leapt here? That in fact, if I were 17 years old, Anonymous would be just as cool a new tray as, you know, all the stuff I was into when I was 17, and I'd be right in there with my Guy Fawkes mask. Is that all that's happening? We're just old?
I don't know. I mean, it would be sad if, you know, I don't have the feeling that nothing is happening. I just have the feeling that most of what's happening is happening on some different field, and has increasingly been happening on some different field since we had that conversation that we're referring back to, that I think, you know, we said it was all going to be exponential change from then on in, and perhaps it has been, but not necessarily in ways that we're able to see.
So I want to segue from that into like kids and parenting advice, because I've been collecting cyberpunk parenting advice. I asked Rudy Rucker when we were thinking about having a kid, and he said, "Oh, you should have a kid. Kids kept me cool." And Rudy's a very, very cool grown-up. And then I asked Bruce Sterling, and Bruce said, "No matter how outre or bohemian I was, that I would inevitably end up embodying contemptible bourgeois normalcy for my kids someday," which is a very Bruce Sterling bit of advice. And Pat Cadigan seems to thrive enormously on the adventures of her kids. And I know you were a stay-at-home dad when you started writing. You wrote your first several books, I think, at home with the kids, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about parenting and kids and generations, because here you are with your kids sort of thrusting themselves into the future that you never tried to predict. And does that make you want to predict the future? Do you ever go, "Gosh, I wish I could think a little more clearly about where my kids are going to end up"?
No, it actually fills me with some, I think it fills me with some anxiety when, as a non-futurist civilian walking down the street, I sometimes try to imagine the actual world that my kids might be living in 20 years. And it's a different, You know, it's a kind of a different sort of ball game. I don't, you know, but as for like being a cyberpunk parent, I doubt that. I really doubt that I would have written very much if we hadn't had kids when we did, and if it hadn't fallen to me economically to be the one who stayed home and took care of them, because I wrote really my first three novels as the house parent while my wife was teaching at university. And you know, you have little kids, they go to sleep and you write. They wake up and you quit writing and they go to sleep and they go to sleep and you write. You can't go out. You can't go to the pub or a coffee shop while they're sleeping. You have to be there. And it helps if you're very poor because you can't afford anything to distract yourself while they're sleeping. So you write. And it was, you know, it's good. It's good that way. One of the things that makes me feel weirdest about science fiction is that moment when you hear a science fiction writer who you've always had some respect for go into one of those After Us, the Deluge rants. That invariably kills it for me. That, you know, you're with somebody who was like incredible, whose work was incredibly stimulating when you were younger, and they're older now and they go into one of those. The kids are just fucked. Everything is going to be bad forever. It's never going to be as good as it was when we were young. Look what they're doing. And, you know, for me, that's like the ultimate turnoff. There's something that just sort of quietly shuts down.
Well, so kids have picked up on a kind of 20-year-old, 25-year-old meme and turned it back into a subculture that has all kinds of funny little network corners, and that's steampunk. And I'm writing the introduction to the 25th anniversary edition of the Difference Engine.
Yeah.
I don't know what to write yet, so I thought I would start by asking you, what would you like to have said about the Difference Engine 25 years later?
That it's an incredibly peculiar piece of work. And basically just that. It's the only novel that I've ever written any of that I go back on a fairly regular basis and reread for pleasure. I don't do that with my own solo outings, but the Difference Engine can still, you know, just I open it at random and read a bit, and it fills me with some kind of loopy delight, and in part because it's so damned peculiar. It really is an extraordinarily odd piece of work, and I, you know, given the personalities involved, I think it's a miracle that it exists at all.
What makes it so peculiar?
Well, when Bruce discovered the word processor, and he beat me to that because his father had had an Apple. His father had had an Apple II, and had gotten an Apple IIc, or maybe a Mac. I think his father had gotten the first Mac, and he gave Bruce the Apple II, and Bruce had never used a computer before. He called me up from Texas. And he said, "I've got this machine here. It changes everything." And I said, "Oh, I don't know. It's still words in a row." And he said, "No, no." He said, "You can chop it up. You can move the bits around." He said, "And you can airbrush the joints." He said, "It's like It's like Burroughs' cut-up method, but you can airbrush the joints and you can't see the difference. And he said, and you can file the serial numbers off anything. And so I went out and got one and was quite happy with it. But I didn't really discover what he meant until we were well into the difference engine. Large hunks of swaths of which consists about 80% of wonderful copyright-free Victorian pulp literature with the they didn't even have serial numbers. Just like put it, you know, collage it in, airbrush the seams, and you've sent your character through something that's so much weirder than anything anybody in the 20th century could ever have imagined, and often with a huge specificity of detail. And whenever I find myself reading one of those parts of the thing, I'm just like, you know, it makes me chortle with delight. They find the corpse of the Texas Ranger who killed Sam Houston's, President Houston's publicist in London. And the corpse is found in an attic. And in this garret, there are dead cacti in cages hanging on the wall. And that's just a detail from an actual sort of, you know, Police Illustrated monthly murder scene. There's no explanation for it. It's just part of the actual Victorian reality.
Today you could have copied and pasted that text out of like Google Book Search or the Internet Archive. You wouldn't even have to rekey the old Victoriana.
Yeah, it's true. And Bruce spent, you know, Bruce did obsessive yeoman duty in the vast Victoriana collection of the University of Texas to photocopy those things and mail them to me in Vancouver. And we go, look at this.
So
look what we could do.
Make magazine just asked Bruce why he thought the Difference Engine came out, and 20 years later, steampunk subculture emerged. And he said that he thought that anything that was too geographically diffused to field its own zine or to form its own convention just didn't start as a subculture until the net came along. And the net made it possible for geographically diffused groups of people, like people who quite like dressing up in brown.
Yeah, that makes
What's her name? Sherry Priest says steampunk is what happens when goths discover brown.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually my single favorite ever statement on steampunk.
Yeah. So you buy that, you think that this is why, that this is what happened in the intervening 20 years, it's just the internet, or
well,
is there something about our moment?
I've never been completely sure. You know, I wouldn't want to be the first to say that steampunk derives exclusively from the difference engine. The difference engine is obviously a sort of proto-steampunk artifact and has a lot of, you know, passionate, wacky descriptions of gear yardage. But it doesn't... The visuals, you know, the visuals I had with the difference engine don't look that much to me like the visuals I see coming out of steampunk. And I actually haven't been, with a few marvelous exceptions, haven't been that impressed with very many steampunk artifacts.
So I have a prop now. So when I blogged this, you said it was, what did you say? You said it was the probably the single best steampunk objet I've seen. What you didn't know is that I'd already bought it. This is
absolutely
this crazy steampunk fetish mask from a guy named Sergei in Ukraine who calls himself Bob Bassett for reasons I don't entirely understand, who makes these awesome, crazy ass, I think they're modeled on old Soviet gas masks, these things. So I'd be interested in hearing what you think makes this different from the other steampunk objet that you've seen.
One way in which it's remarkably different is there's no extraneous decoration. And there's an excess of there's an excess of extraneous decoration in quite a lot of steampunk makings, and I think it comes from probably an instinct to reverse modernism's stripping of decoration. But when you simply reapply decoration to late modernist objects, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. The modernists got rid of it because they perceived most of it as being a kind of florid romantic kitsch anyway. And putting florid romantic kitsch back on something doesn't make it better for me. This, however, is completely bent and and peculiar and slightly disturbing.
You know, it strikes me that the kind of inverse of steampunk subculture is mall ninja subculture, because it's mall ninja subculture is all about not admitting that you're pretending, and mall ninja subculture is about this kind of, it's a posture of deadly seriousness, you know, that this, you know, this, as near as I can work out, the mall ninjas in Zero History have their origin in this wonderful shrine to the mall ninja on the internet, is that right?
I wish they did.
No?
I know the shrine to the mall ninja. But the mall ninjas in Zero History have their origin in a web galaxy of stuff for people who aren't military and aren't law enforcement officers, but who, as near as I can make out, want other people to think that they're probably carrying a gun.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's every accessory ever conceived of for a Crown Vic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's, and yet, I don't think they are carrying guns. So I can't really see where the fantasy goes. And it's interestingly, it's the mall ninja look is the opposite of what security people call the gray man look, which is the way you dress when you're carrying a gun, and you don't want anybody to notice you at all. And the guys who do that wear baggy khakis and these days almost invariably striped polo shirts. Striped polo shirts in Afghanistan are the new I'm an operator badge.
Wow.
And if you wore one in Afghanistan without being an operator, someone would tell you not to do it.
Do they? Is it just gang colors, or is it something about the way that a striped polo shirt deforms, that hides the stripes themselves are like razzle dazzle?
No, it's things like this are almost arbitrary. It's a power costume. Hmm. And it actually goes with a particular cut of beard. I was told recently, like a particular shape of beard, baggy sort of, you know, Ralph Lauren polo chinos, and a regular short-sleeved,
wow,
horizontal
profiteer chic.
Yeah, and. It could have been anything. I mean, it could have been a cowboy shirt. Hmm. But it's
only
just,
then they would have blended in Brooklyn again. So.
Yeah, it's just the code. But none of those guys would be caught dead wearing any of those tactical things.
Yeah. Well, I think we're at Q&A time here. Let's open it up. I don't know, are there mics for questions, or are we just repeating them? Hannah, or are we just repeating the questions, or are there mics? There's mics. Are the mics making their way through the crowd? We're just trying to find them. Well, you know, while we're waiting for the mics, rather than sitting here pretending we're not, if someone with a big voice wants to call out a question. Yes? So is Milgram a stand-in for you?
No, not entirely. I mean, not in any literal way. Although Milgram has an unusual advent story compared to most of my characters. Most of my characters arrive gradually and the characters are the part of the narrative that comes in for me when I'm not actually writing. It's like 99% of it happens for me when my fingers are tapping on a keyboard, and it doesn't really happen otherwise. But the characters tend to sort of ghost in gradually and build themselves up in my peripheral vision. But with Milgram, when I was trying to get Spook Country started, I was playing with the idea of using Brown, the Milgram's captor, the man who becomes Milgram's captor in the actual book. I was playing with the idea of using that character, who's a bad guy, as the other viewpoint character, which was something I hadn't done before. And I couldn't get it to work, and I was writing a scene that ultimately made it into the book, where Brown is picking a lock to get into Tito's room to change the batteries on some sort of bug hidden under a hat rack. And I just could not get the lock undone. I'd been like 3 days, I couldn't make it, you know how when you just can't make it go forward. And in this sort of really half-assed way, without thinking about it at all, I put a stick man in front of Brown and gave the stick man the point of view. And the stick man was unlocking the door. And then Brown shoved him into Tito's room. And literally, as the stick man crossed the threshold, he became Milgram in very, very large part, and within 5 minutes he was obsessed with how the benzodiazepine tablet was melting under his tongue, and I could feel very viscerally what his relationship with Brown was. And so it's very unusual, that's very unusual for me, and he became a really valuable character in that the way his sort of his neurological damage and specific pathologies rendered him the perfect lens through which to observe certain parts of the narrative. But he's not so much based on my sense of myself. He's not really based on my experience at all. I've never been addicted to benzodiazepines. In fact, I chose benzodiazepines so that there would be no possible way for anyone to romanticize the drug use in the novel. And just about any other drug that people can abuse has some sort of culty thing going on around it.
Right. But no one's ever going to go benzo chic.
No.
Yeah. Next question. We have a mic. A show of hands, please. Yeah, there we go.
Hi there. Was there any kind of moment that you decided in this first book, before writing the first book in this trilogy, that you wanted to write a character, a cultural recycler like Big End?
No. There's Big End, I originally assumed, I assumed in pattern recognition that Big End would be, initially assumed that he would be an occasional walk-on character whose job would be to walk on, give Case Pollard some impossible mission, and charge up her American Express card. And I really thought that that was all he would be doing. As soon as I got him on stage, he started spouting quasi-situationist gibberish that seemed to make a weird sort of sense. And, you know, I sort of backed off and let him go for it. And, you know, lo and behold, he became, I think, the only common character straight through the three books. And like I had no idea. And I'm totally happiest working from the dream state. I only wish it were easier to find it.
I always thought that Big End was kind of the bizarro world Bill Gibson recycling pop culture and making money out of it. And
yeah, he might be, although I know that I was thinking today, I guess because I'm in London, that my very brief and not very major Hollywood involvement with Malcolm McLaren has something to do with Big End, because in McLaren in Hollywood up close was literally, you know, sort of the most like the perfect chancer. He just didn't care, you know, he really didn't care about the outcome, other than it seemed as though he would do anything at all just to see what was going to happen. And he could run rings around Hollywood business people. He just couldn't get them to do anything. Or he could terrify them into an amazing uneasy silence, which I thought was a pretty good trick.
More questions? There's a hand up in the balcony. I don't know if you're allowed to ask from up there. Do you want to give us Juliet from the balcony? So the question is, does being a happy consumer put you at odds with finding out too much about China?
No, I tend to be a happy consumer of things from Japan. in large part, to the detriment of my wallet. It may be, you know, what you're suggesting about China may be part of why it hasn't really grabbed me in the same way that Japan has.
Although it's funny that like Foxconn assembly line suicides have a kind of horribleness to them that salaryman working yourself to death and dropping, or, you know, jobless recovery, giant collections of broken people and camping in the parks for 25 years in Tokyo seem to not have that kind of horribleness that we associate with Chinese factory life.
No, that's true. I mean, it's fairly arbitrary, but I mean, it's not that I live in Vancouver, happily surrounded by tons of contemporary Chinese culture, and it's very, very nice. And I'd be unhappy if it went away. But it's still not where I look for some spark of. It's not where I look for novelty in the same way. not now. It may be one day. I mean, there's nothing inherent or absolute about it. But somehow the Japanese just totally have my number. I can't help it. They get me going every time.
More questions? One over there. Yeah.
Hi, you talked about the dream state and how you find it easier to write then. What advice would you give to burgeoning young writers and writers in general in relation to that in terms of how to go about turning their ideas into fiction?
Well, I mean, I always get back to this totally annoying advice that Robert A. Heinlein gave, which I still think is the best advice for young writers, and it's that you have to write, you have to finish what you write, you have to submit what you write for publication. While you're waiting for it to be rejected, you have to write something else. And, you know, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. If you don't keep doing that over and over, nothing will happen. And I think I first read that when I was about 14 years old, and I still think it's the best advice. I mean, I wouldn't try to teach anyone to write the way I write, because it would drive somebody else crazy or lead them, result in absolute failure. But if you follow Heinlein's advice, you'll discover your own way of doing it, which will be absolutely as peculiar and idiosyncratic as mine, but it will work for you because it's yours. And you won't get there unless you follow Heinlein's advice. And you have to write. You have to sort of write all the time. And it's for anyone considering becoming a writer, one thing you have to ask yourself is how comfortable you are spending big hunks of your time regularly in the absence of everyone else in the world, because it's a very solitary thing to do. And I mean, I sometimes imagine what it would be like living with a writer. I imagine myself married to a writer, and I just kind of go, ew. And then I look at my wife, and I, feel like increased gratitude, because she, for some reason, is the one woman in 1,000 who's quite happy with a guy who goes in the basement all day. And only occasionally pops out, but then goes into like weird peripatetic periods of enforced self-promotion, like this one. Right. But really, if you want to write, you have to write, you have to finish it, and you either have to submit it for publication or show it to another human being. And you have to get used to doing that. Otherwise, it's unlikely that much will happen.
I think the best writing advice that I didn't listen to for the longest time was to write every day. And I always assumed that people who said that were like people who claim that you should drink, 16 glasses of water a day and exercise for an hour every day and eat 5 servings of vegetables every day. And they were just sort of kidding. And it wasn't until I started writing every day that I realized that a thing that you do every day, even if it doesn't become easy, it becomes automatic.
Yeah. Well, I have to turn up every day. And that was really crucial for me when I was starting out to get that. Like, there are days when I turn up and nothing happens. Or there are days when I turn up and I write a little bit and it's just not good. But there aren't too many of those, and the important thing is turning up and assuming the position and making oneself ready for the writing to happen, and then trying to do it. Sometimes I start and it's not good and it's not happening, and then suddenly it starts. And it's not when the writing, I don't have any control over when the writing thing comes. So the best I can do is to go every day to the hole in the fence where the writing thing is known to come. And it optimizes the chances the writing thing comes. And the more, if you can get the writing thing really, really going, it'll come every day for weeks on end.
More show of hands. You need to wave at the microphone people, not at the stage people.
Could I ask you about your relationship with music and if it's changed? Hi. If it's changed from when you first started writing to now, and how you see music now and in the future?
Well, it's much more... When I started writing, I think I was near the end of a stage in my life in which I took it absolutely for granted that who I was in some large sense informed by who I was listening to. And in some ways I started writing out of a sort of very delayed adolescence. Like I was about 25 when I started trying to take it seriously, but in some ways I was a very young 25, and it was all still terribly important to me who I listened to, and if you didn't listen to who I listened to, you probably weren't really, really with it. And I don't have that relationship to music now. I just listen to what I like to listen to and take what pleasure I can from it. And I'm not at all evangelical. So I think that when I started, music was like the tail end of the children's crusade of the 60s for me. And it was still sort of illuminated with that. So now it's not... I think popular music has gradually become less of a source of imagery for me. That would be one way to put it.
More questions?
Hello. I started reading Zero History on Sunday on a Kindle, and I'm not very far through, but I swipe what are any longer pages, and suddenly things are underlined, and it says, four other people highlighted this passage, kind of like when there's something really pithy. And it's a really strange experience to me as a reader that I can suddenly see what other people are at that level are enjoying in a book. I was wondering if you'd come across this and you find it as a new experience as a writer and how you might influence your writing going forward.
Oh, I've never even heard of that. Is that...
It's really weird.
Is that the ordinary experience of reading on a Kindle, that other readers' interlineations appear at your copy? Really? That's bizarre. Can you turn it off? I'm sorry. It's one of the reasons I've never become a very keen library user is that I hate it when people write in books. It drives me mad. I don't care what struck them in that paragraph. I don't care that they thought that sentence was good, star. No, that would dry it. That's so bizarre. Well, very strange. I've I've actually signed the text. I've signed an e-copy of Zero History, I think in a Kindle edition, but on an iPad. I don't think you can do it yet on a Kindle, but you can do it. You can do it on an iPad. So I got a conductive stylus. No, that's not it. It's much shorter. It's a strange short conductive stylus for signing e-copies.
I always use a Sharpie to sign the back, and people think it's great fun to have me sign the iPad because I wrote that editorial about iPads, and I turned the Apple into a little skull and crossbones.
They think it's great. I can understand with you because there's history, because you've had issues, but they think it's great fun to get me to sign Kindles too, and I go along with it, but I don't really get it.
Mr. Gibson, will you sign my cyberspace?
Yeah.
I brought this OED.
That would be good, actually.
More questions?
Thanks. Bruce Sterling talks about we're in an age of atemporality and that we're on a transition to nowhere. And Charlie Stross, I think it is, talks about how when he writes science fiction, it happens before he's finished writing the book. I'm sort of confused as to whether it's possible to have both of those happening at the same time, and whether, as you said, to look at the stuff that's interesting around us and what have legs, and maybe there just isn't anything really interesting around us at the moment.
I find everything. My problem is I find everything increasingly interesting, and I just can't imagine where that's going to go. I mean, you know, maybe when I'm older, I'll just gape at everything and wonder. But, you know, you could do worse, really. But no, I find this an extraordinarily interesting and complex time. But it does change so quickly that extrapolation in the traditional sense has become very difficult. I think that when I was first reading science fiction, which would have been in the late 1950s, the consensual now was 3 or 4 years long. And with 3 or 4 years of relatively unchanging now, a writer of science fiction had the space in which to erect something like Heinlein's goofy future history. You know, with that long and now, you could build a relatively big structure before that now hauled itself into the future that made your big structure obsolete. But today, now can feel like a news cycle. It's like the now is too now and too narrow to allow for that big a construct. We have too many wild cards in play with regard to our future to casually erect believable futures, you know, beyond a few years. Or it feels that way. It feels that way to me. I mean, sometimes when I sit down and think, okay, what could I do if I were going to do 2060 next time? And, you know, what am I going to do about global warming? What am I going, you know, there's this long list of things that one has to account for now in order to make a satisfying 2060.
Didn't you say Neuromancer was optimistic because it wasn't set in clouds of radioactive ash?
Yeah, absolutely. I genuinely felt when I was writing Neuromancer that I was committing an act of wholly uncharacteristic optimism, because I was depicting a world in which there had been a nuclear war, but it had only been a tiny little nuclear war, and it had caused the multinationals of the world to basically balkanize the United States and make sure and somehow cripple the Soviet Union, which had remained there rusting away, and make sure they never got into it again, because it was bad for business. And that's implicit in the backstory of Neuromancer. And I was very careful working that in to make sure it was fairly readable. And it was just like this crazy, it just felt like this glorious wish fulfillment thing for me, because in 1981, when I started thinking about doing something like Neuromancer, there were lots and lots of perfectly realistic and intelligent and well-informed people in the world who quite reasonably assumed we just weren't going to make it. And one of the things I find interesting about the world today is the way in which that the psychic reality of that Cold War fear has so completely evaporated that it's almost impossible to convey it to someone who didn't know it.
You don't think hysterical Islamophobia, the kind of way out there, you know, they're secretly going to put mosques at every sacred site to Christianity kind of madness is not that just where that free-floating anxiety landed?
It may be where the free-floating anxiety landed, but it's bonkers. Whereas the belief that the United States, the assumption that the United States and the Soviet Union were going to vaporize each other and everyone else in the process at literally any minute wasn't bonkers. Mm-hmm. Wasn't bonkers. It was all, you know, ready to go, and came very close a couple of times. And it wasn't tribalistic, it was technological. Hmm. And so it was a different sort of fear.
For the record, I think Charlie's just being silly. You know, speaking as someone who's writing a novel with Charlie, whenever we come up against something that seems like it may exist today, we just make fun of it. It's a very easy futuristic technique to adopt, and he's been doing it at the rate of about 250,000 words a year for about 4 years now without showing any sign of slowing down, and it's great work. So I think that he's worrying about nothing.
I'm over here. I was wondering, there's an interesting kind of parallel with this. My background is in anthropology, as somebody who kind of remembers being very young and watching what turned out to kind of be now contextualized as the last vestiges of modernity really falling down, like kind of the Cold War ending and having that weird straddling of sort of history as knowable, which then collided with history as sort of actually unknowable, and then went on to study this. And one of the things that's interesting is you read about like the golden age of anthropology, where people think they can know and they can predict the future, and that the point of kind of a lot of human endeavor is to get that predictability in there, versus this kind of crisis that happens with thinking in really in the 80s and goes on through the 90s, where the knowable isn't really knowable for a huge host of reasons, like this sort of humanity comes back into things. And I wonder if you feel like maybe some of the shift in this cycle of the new is not just like a technological reality, but is also sort of like a totally different paradigm that kind of comes in because the hubris kind of evaporates, like after the structural reality of, you know, the Cold War and what modernity was kind of seen to mean and deliver falls down, you know, you're left with a reconceptualizing of everything.
Well, yes. I couldn't... I like that. I like that, although I couldn't paraphrase it to save my life. But it sounds very much like the inside of my own head sometimes. So, yeah, something like that. I do think that there are sort of overlapping and ongoing and innumerable paradigm shifts underway for us right now in a way that isn't entirely unprecedented. I think if we looked more closely at what the Victorians went through here, we'd find some very similar tonalities. Things changed here very quickly, and not everyone liked it, but they also had no idea how crazy it made them. Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing that's going on, if I could have anything from the future, just one specific body of knowledge from the future, and that would be all I could get, I'd want to know what they think about us. I'd want to know how they see us, because I think that would be the crucial thing. Because if you look at the way the Victorians saw themselves, as opposed to the way we see them, and that's continuing to change as our forensic abilities increase, there's just no comparison. They had, relatively speaking, no self-knowledge. I would propose that from the point of view of the future, we are equally without self-knowledge.
Well put. I think we're at time, is that right? Well, it remains only for me to thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
To say that if there's one quote I'll take away from this, it's, my problem is that I find everything increasingly interesting. I think I'm going to have it on my tombstone. Thanks. So,
it's a good way to be.
We'll be in the lobby next. Thank you.
All the Intelligence Squared archive is available in video format at intelligencesquared.com. or youtube.com/IQ squared. And you can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes.